If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
Regardless of what industry or profession you're coming from, if you treat your employees the way you want them to treat your top customers or clients, you're going to have success. They're going to treat their customers the way you treat them.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Abel Pacheco and his wife have been investing in real estate since 2008. Abel has invested in $93 million of commercial real estate, 800 doors across five multifamily apartment communities as an active and passive investor. He's a principal in 400 doors and developing a Class A multifamily ground-up project. Where does the name Five Talents come from? Matthew 25:14-30. We believe in being good stewards of the resources God provided us with and good stewards of the capital our investors trust us with. Abel, welcome to the show.
Hey, Sam. Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it. I'm excited to be here and just privileged, humbled to be a guest.
Hey, man, the pleasure is all mine. And I always love interviewing people with the same haircut as me. So I see we've got the same barber.
No doubt. Yeah, we went to the right place to get a haircut and looking trim, looking neat. Looks good.
Absolutely, man. The same questions I ask everybody who comes on the show is, where did you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
All right. Well, where did I start? I'm Corpus Christi, Texas native. So I grew up at the beach. I moved to San Antonio, Texas, the Alamo City, to go to school at UTSA. And I've been in San Antonio pretty much my adult life and started investing in 2008 in real estate. So I have been a salesperson as long as I can remember. Grew up with it, my dad, and then I started my own business as a sales guy. I worked for Cutco Sales. So Cutco Knives, where we do in-home presentations. I did that through college. So I kind of sold in-home presentations, did that, paid my way through school. And then I started as a tech, an IT tech salesperson for a company called Rackspace. We went from 500 or 600 employees to 6,000 employees, $100 million a year business to about $2 billion. So I was a sales professional there. And that's pretty much where I stayed. Like, I always did sales and just kind of realized if I stopped working as a sales professional, the checks would stop coming in as well. So I had to figure out how to put the commission into something that was going to create some passive income. So that was the journey since 2008. Every time we would get a good commission, we'd save all the money we could. We lived pretty modestly, me and my wife, 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom house, 1,200 square feet. We did that for as long as we could and had a little inexpensive cars that we could pay off. And everything else went to savings. We buy another house. Then we bought a second house, a rental, and a third and a fourth. And we bought about 8 houses over 10 years. And that's where all of our money went to. And my wife was in tech too. We worked together at the same company here in San Antonio, Texas, and ultimately just figured out there was a different way to do real estate, not 100% of our own money, using partners. I didn't use partners prior, and buying bigger deals that we were able to buy as a team together with multiple people, something we didn't have to have 100% of the resources, 100% of the knowledge. We got to leverage other expertise, time, money, people. And then we all work together and go buy commercial buildings. So that's what got me to where I am today. So let me pause here and say, if this was that background helpful?
Absolutely. Absolutely helpful. I would love to, if we have more time, I'd dig into your Cutco story. I think, you know, anybody who's hustled knives door to door, you know, yeah, has really earned their stripes. But, you know, let's keep it. So just hats off to you for doing that. Thanks. One. Secondly, though, you had mentioned that you initially didn't use other resources and didn't work with other people. When was that light bulb moment when you said, wait, I can do more with other partners?
Yeah. So after we bought our like 6th or 7th house, I was like, this got to be a different way. That was the first time I used property management. So I was doing the landlording myself as well. And we hired a third party property manager. I realized, oh, I can also leverage them for this. what else can I learn, you know, how to leverage? And we started investing in ourselves, education. So we went to a real estate conference and seminar and went for the weekend and then ended up signing up for the year and then traveling a bunch of different states, cities, and going to that education. And that's what really broadened the horizon to all these different things that I didn't even know were possible in real estate. Raising capital, didn't think about doing it. Like, just so naive in the real estate world, because I was the guy in my circle that had the most houses. So everyone would ask me the real estate questions. And so my paradigm was like, oh yeah, I'm looking around and nobody has 5 or 6 or 7 houses. So I guess I am the pro. Let me help you and show you what I did. But I didn't even know anybody at that point that was really doing like 20, 30, 100 houses or apartment buildings. The moment I went to that education seminar, they started saying, oh, here's how to market for properties. Here's how to buy them direct. Here's how to raise capital. Here's how to do assignments. Here's how to syndicate. Here's how to look at commercial properties. Here's how to, you know, look at warehouses versus apartment buildings. And here's a pro forma. Let's analyze this thing. So that education was really what broadened it all up. And then the little portion I put into practice, let me property manage some of the assets. So I had more time and freedom. And then slowly but surely, I added one thing I learned and started taking action one at a time. And then it just kind of all snowballed into the now we're in 800 doors. Well, I said the 8 to 800, right? The tagline. Because it took us 10 years to buy 8 houses. It took us less than 2 years to get into 800 doors. But now I'm a principal and, you know, an operator in about 650 as a general partner principal. Mm. And then another 400 plus as a limited partner. So we're in over 1,000 today.
Wow, man, that's awesome. That's awesome. You need to update your bio here. It says,
yeah, I still like this 8 to 800 tagline because I'm this 8 to 800 thing. We're actually writing a book, and I think that's going to be the title.
I love it, man. That is fantastic. At what point in time did you decide to go into bigger multifamily?
Man, this is probably like 2018. I made my first passive investment.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. So, not that long ago.
No, pretty quick.
And then from passive to active investing, then when did you buy your first multifamily project on your own?
2019. So we made 3 passive investments, me twice, my wife once. That was 400 doors, and my wife 280 something on her own. And that was the passive, passive, passive. And all that time, 6 to 9 months-ish of investing passively, education at the same time, and talking to other friends, family members, people from work, coworkers that wanted to learn more about what we were doing. And those are my first passive investors into my first deal in 2019. It was 124 units. And then we backed it up with a 268 unit property at the end of 2019.
Wow. What were some things, I guess, that you learned along the way as a passive investor that you are now implementing in your business?
Yeah. As a passive investor, I learned you got to look at the deal, the market, and the team. And those 3 things are like the primary components that I tell people today, all our investors, deal, market, team. That's your job as a passive investor. And as a general partner, I'm actually looking at the same exact things, just way more details that I'm trying to dig in further. But I want to know about the deal. Does it have good return projections? Can I buy it at the right price? What's my competition? How am I going to increase income or reduce expenses? How am I going to operate this thing more efficiently? And can I get the returns I'm looking for? The market, I want to look at the market mechanics, population growth, different corporations that are coming to the city. How's my economic development working out? Those market mechanics, a little bit of supply and demand too, that's important. In San Antonio, Texas, I'm definitely looking at an opportunity where there's more population growth continually coming in. And Texas and some of the other hard markets, more people coming in, higher demand for housing. When you have a old school graph of supply and demand chart, supply goes down, demand goes up, so do prices. I want to be in that part of the curve. And so the last thing is the team. Just you trust them. No, like, and trust, people always say, but it's literally the truth. My first deal, I didn't know how to read a pro forma or look at the investment. Or even if I read it, would I really have known that they're correct? Oh, your market assumptions are, we're going to grow organic growth by 3%. Well, how do I know that's accurate? I didn't know about CoStar or any of those things. And, you know, back then it was 100% based on trust with my syndicator and operator. And I looked and I asked, and he gave me his track record. Well, I've done it three times. This is, you know, the third or whatever the time it was. And I was like, yeah, let's go. It was highly based on trust. So I think those are good. But now that I know a little bit more, you know, I just dig in a further onto know, like, and trust on people that I want to work with, partners, and then to do the same for property management, asset management, construction management, all the different things that are needed. So hopefully that helps.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I don't want to stay here for just one more minute. On the passive side, are there some things that, or some experiences you had that you said, hey, I'm going to do this better?
Man, my main partner was, he was on point. He pretty much, in my opinion, set a great bar for me, because I just thought that was the standard. A monthly reporting, standard. Pictures of the property, of ongoing, you know, improvements, standard. Here's my return projections and my check, and my quarterly check back then. And now I think he's moved to monthly. And then good, smooth structure from portal, logging in, being able to have those electronic signature, electronic doc, seamless, you know, investment process. And then, you know, good reporting frequently. It makes me feel like I'm in that deal as a passive investor. And that, you know, makes me feel, oh, shoot, this is my property. And it is, but as a limited partner, sometimes you're distant. This is not really my property. It is. You're an owner. You're a K-1 owner. You get a tax document that says K-1, you're a partner all the way through. But to feel like that, I haven't been with other partners or as a passive investor in other deals along that route, but I've heard others examples that are not as smooth. And so that's where I go, okay, I'm really trying to implement, create a best in service. And my buddy did work where I worked at Rackspace. So we had a tagline that was fanatical support, great customer service. So we wanted that experience for our customers back then. And, you know, we're trying to recreate a little bit of that. So to help passive investors kind of feel that same experience, white glove approach, so to speak.
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think there's very little you can overcome as long as there's good communication. I think you hit on that, and that does make people really feel like they're in on the deal. Mm-hmm. And that's really cool that you don't have those negative experiences that go back on and say, hey, I'm going to do this differently.
Yeah.
You know, because I think there's plenty.
I did. I lucked out.
Yeah, absolutely. Good for you, man. Hey, and you got the bar set high for you. Mm-hmm. So sometimes that's even harder, as opposed to knowing not where to go. It's going, oh crud. Now mm-hmm. I got to try to live up to that.
Yeah.
So, well done.
And part of it, that one thing I have learned along the way is that I can try to create somewhat of a similar experience. But then as an investor, if anybody's listening that's trying to move from passive to active or go create their own business, I also have to sit back and say, well, he's been doing it for many more years than I have. And so where was he at that point, and vice versa? Anybody that's outside looking in, if you're looking at this model, say, well, how do they buy a 100 unit deal? How do they buy on a 200 deal? How are they raising $5 million? Well, they didn't start that way. Everyone has a first deal. Everyone has a first rough obstacle or path to learn from and to get to the other side to. So the more you can just engulf yourself in it, whether you're passive and you want to do the next deal or you're trying to move to active, you got to get your hands dirty. You got to get that experience, and you're going to pay, quote unquote, pay some dues, just like any other, you know, industry or job or profession. Got to start taking your lumps and get in there. And then on the other side of that, you'll have those years of experience to say, oh, this is how, you know, we've evolved over time, right? Because I'm assuming his first or second deal was probably not as smooth as when I caught him later on in the process and now that I see him. So,
right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Tell us about your first deal, your first multifamily deal.
My first one was 124 units. It was three general partners. I was one of three. And it was San Antonio, Texas. And property was a little around $7 million. And it was a good value add play. So they had a lot of classic units. It was our job to renovate them. And, you know, we're doing a number of renovations. I forget what the exact increase that we underwritten, but whenever you're able to overperform and doing better in it, you're happy. And I think the rent bumps were probably like 50 or 75 bucks ish a month, and doing well on those. And essentially what we did was we raised a couple $1 million. The bank gave us the majority of the money, 70-75%, I think, LTV. And then we brought in the rest of the cash, and then we closed the deal. And we started with external or third-party property management. And then since have brought that in-house, vertically integrated property management. And that's my partner that I'm working with. And he's kind of at that level where he's doing his own property management. And, you know, that was just a really strong deal and a B neighborhood, C property. It was a 70s property. Did have pitch roof, some of them, and some of them were flat. I think it's a mix match, a couple different roof and buildings, and in a great neighborhood. The high school is a really strong one. So whenever you have that area where the high average median income is going to be good, and then for the deal you have, or the around your property, you have neighborhoods with some really nice houses that are higher, you know, average price. That's a good area where some people can't afford to live in a house in that spot, but they sure want their kids to go to a nice school. So they rent from an apartment building in that area, get their kids in a great school, and we're happy, they're happy. So yeah, that was our first deal. We haven't exited, so I haven't gone on a full cycle. 2019 was that first one. And we actually looked at some, or kind of talking about, like, is this the right time to sell? We're like, probably hold on to this one for a little bit longer. And yeah, first property.
Right. Yeah, that's fantastic. You said that you had brought management in-house.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What was that experience like when, not just when you kind of looked at the numbers and said, all right, you know, this might make, all right, well, actually, let's do talk about that. What were the factors that made you say, hey, let's take this in-house?
Well, so it was me and three partners, and we had a fun go during COVID. And there was a couple, I guess, sort of speak, some balls dropped, payments, this and that, vendors, things like that. And so we thought it was a big enough risk. We don't want to deal with it. And my partner at the time, same one that I invested with passively, the same one I did my first GP deal with, had a number of doors already, probably now he's in the couple thousands, if not more. But in the beginning, you know, he was going from 3, 4, 5, 6 properties, 1,000. You have enough to all locally, enough to create his own property management company. So for him, it was basically like hiring or recruiting or headhunting, whatever you want to call it, one of the best people that he had worked with at some of the other third-party property management companies. And that's the, I guess, quote-unquote, vertically integrated. Hire him. He's the regional. And he had been doing his own role, but now at his company. So treat him, you know, partner up on a property management company. And technically for me, it's a little bit of the same. The property manager was doing the thing. Now we have a new property manager, except he seems to be one of the top, he's one of the top guys that was recruited. So for me, my interaction with him is like, man, he knows your game. So he's our property management regional for the new deal. And I'm just kind of a beneficiary as one of the three sponsors in the deal.
Right, right. And there's nothing illegal about poaching top talent.
It's business is business. So yeah, if you could pay them what they're worth, and somebody was underappreciated at one entity and now they're crushing it at yours, well, if you're the business owner, you're going to benefit. So, you know, that's definitely one of those things that regardless of what industry or profession you're coming from, if you treat your employees the way you want them to treat your top customers or clients, you're going to have success. They're going to treat their customers the way you treat them. So it's just something we've always learned, or I always learned from a customer service for nautical support aspect coming back from my old professional days. What was that, right? If people want to, you know, have an inspiring mission, they want to be on a winning team and a valuable member of that winning team. And that was like a Graham Weston quote. And he did a TED talk around that. So kind of grew up in that space where culture really matters. So if you can create that culture among, you know, your business, you're going to win. You're going to win.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And to rewind a little bit, you know, you said that, you know, you had a fun go in 2020 where your other property management, which kind of inspired you guys to look for other people, where there were just some things that were getting dropped. And you said, hey, we've got to solve this.
Yeah. Before it became an issue. And that's exactly. Yep.
Yeah. No, I love that proactive approach to solving problems. That's not an easy decision. I wouldn't think.
Especially during 2020, right? Everything was a little bit just kind of crazy and hairy, right? Everything seemed like it was more important. Every cycle, every decision, you had to be super efficient. We were almost preparing for something that maybe didn't really happen in San Antonio, Texas. So we didn't have a crazy hardships like California or New York or the super dense areas. But come March and April, we didn't know how bad it was going to get. So everybody had to, you know, get super efficient, get super tight, and just make sure those hard decisions are made early and then before it became an issue. So yeah, it was a good decision. Great decision.
Right, right. If you could rewind 2 or 3 years, what are some things you might have done differently or you might do differently that would have maybe propelled you forward faster?
Let's see. I would have started a fund faster. So I was just about to get fund number 2 started. So we created a fund at the end of last year. It's just about to get closed out now. It's a 506C, which I feel comfortable talking about it here. For those that don't know, accredited investors are the only people that can invest in it. So I can talk about it openly and quote unquote advertise, right? So this fund was created as that deal that propelled me to kind of do the second fund, which will be starting soon. And looking back on it, I had partnered with many multiple teams to create now 7 active deals and 8th is the fund, right? So we've done a bunch of deals. However, there's some power in leveraging commits, people that were actually would go in. So I raised capital 1 at a time and I had more investors every single time. So we're super blessed, super happy. And it feels like we made the best decisions possible. But if I could go back, I would have almost believed in myself a little bit more, removed the limiting belief hat and said, you know what? I'm going to have like 40, 50, 100 investors, 200 investors at some point. It would probably be smart to have a 506C offer, create a fund where I can publicly advertise, tell everyone what we're doing. And no one may have invested early on in this fund, but as the track record continues and we're on now deal number 7 and I can feel the exits starting to happen over the next couple of years, I would love to have been able to say, hey, this is fund number 1, 2, 3, 4, whatever, and still have the flexibility to buy deals, my deals that we're buying, or invest in someone else's deal if our fund should really be a part of it. So that's kind of how I look at it now. But I think I just came to that conclusion like a couple of weeks ago. And I'm excited for the future though. We are starting this next fund. We are starting an opportunity or the ability to kind of be in the best deal, whether I'm leading it or another amazing team is doing it.
Right. And that brings up a very interesting point. And I don't need to rehash it, but that's it.
Okay.
Like you know, we all come across great deals. And so if it's advantageous to you and your investor to participate in it, this gives you an opportunity to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So
that's really, really cool. As opposed to being, you know, siloed only in what you find, you can now look outside of that. What was the size of the first fund?
It was a $5 million cap. We're still raising right now. As soon as we close this, like a first deal, I think we're going to close it. So probably any moment now. And then that fund is basically an easy button for me. It was a fund of funds. So we raised our pool of capital and we're sticking it in as an LP into a much larger fund being run by some huge entities and firms, Graystar, Pinnacle, the number 1, number 3 operators in the world, RealPage, RealManage, amazing software. That fund supports a nonprofit, which is called Apartment Life. Apartment Life has basically, they serve multiple apartment communities, like literally a million some odd residents, and they're all over the country. So anyways, that fund is supporting the nonprofit and making a good return at the same time. Well, that investment was $1 million minimum investment. So what we did was we raised our fund and we're riding it as an LP. So it was kind of like a opportunity to get our feet wet in as fund management, work on this opportunity that's invested in great real estate in 9 different markets where I didn't have to be the deal finder or the operator. I'm rather relying on large, you know, institutional grade, huge publicly traded companies to go create the first faith-based REIT is what they're doing, and they'll sell it and exit as a REIT. So I kind of applied that model and then I go, well, this is really freaking cool. Maybe I can, on my smaller level, let's get after it. And I get excited. I forgot your actual question, Sam, but hopefully this has helped.
All good, man. I commonly forget what I was talking about right in the middle of like, where are we again? I'm just over here talking. So
I get excited and I start to share. So anyways.
Love it. No, I love it. One last question before we jump here into the final 4. Is your strategy for the second fund going to be different than the first?
Yeah. So that first one was, even though it was diversified across all multiple different assets for the next 7 years. So our investors are coming in and it'll be diversified across the way. Even if I close it, right, they're still buying. However, the second fund, that was also my most difficult raise because I'm essentially saying, hey, trust me with some money. trust me, we'll buy good deals. And they're like, well, what are those deals, right?
Right.
So the second one we're going to do is almost a, it'll be a fund where people can commit. And then we're going to do a call for capital when we find the actual deal so that they can still say, oh, I want it. I'm opting into that deal. And it'll be one deal at a time that the fund will be investing in. So I think that's the main difference between the second one.
Gotcha. So how does that differ from a standard syndication?
Well, I'm still going to do, like, let's say for my deals, we'll still do a syndication and I'll still do that one deal at a time for those investors that maybe didn't qualify for that accredited investor mark and still do a Regulation D 506B deal. We'll take that deal down, pre-existing relationships for people that aren't accredited. But for the other one, I'll basically give some accredited different return option. So some investors want pref and some just want all the upside. So I'm going to create that pref and then all upside and still have my deal going here.
Right, man, that's awesome. I mean, what progress you've made in just a couple, really two and a half short years of hustling it out. So I love to see it. Let's jump here into the final four. First question is this: what is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
You got to take action. Education without action, it doesn't help you. So get education, everything you possibly can to learn all you can, but you have to apply it. So take action as quickly as possible.
Oh man, that's you're spot on. The number of people I've talked to that haven't taken that first piece of advice is, it's painful to watch, but you're absolutely right. Take action. Number two is, when it comes to investing in yourself, what is one thing you're doing to stay on top of your game?
Well, today I am reading more books on other things than just real estate. I am trying to read the word more, dig into the Bible in the morning and in the evening, saying my prayers really is, I would say, man, a lot of success. It just helped me so much. But the books and education, that part of it's helped my success. Sorry. However, just being with the Lord, he's really blessed me, guided me. And that's my biggest area of building on myself and making sure that I kind of sow into that part of my life. And it was probably it right there.
Fantastic. When it comes to investing in the world, what is one way you're making the world a better place?
Well, I have two of my deals that are investing in, or that have a portion of the general partner profits. So the GP slice of the pie with nonprofits in them. I really like this model. So the first fund had it, 120 unit deal that we did in outside of Dallas in Greenville. We gave away a piece of our GP to a nonprofit as well. And it's something about being able to write bigger checks than I would have never been able to do. It's like syndication. I'm buying bigger real estate than I would have ever been able to buy on my own. Well, we can also in this model give bigger than we've been able to give on our own. So we're leveraging that power, and that's kind of how we're trying to give back.
Yeah, no, I love that. I love that because it presents not just a like one-time check, like, oh, hey, here's 10 grand, you know, God bless you, have a good time. It's like, hey, you actually have unlimited upside in this deal like everyone else. You are a member, and hang on, because hopefully we hit a home run. So that's a lot of fun. Abel, if the listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
Our website, 5tcre.com/invest is probably the best and easiest way. You can go all the links and find our events and education, all that good stuff on our website. So that's 5T like Tango, Charlie, Romeo, Echo.com.
Awesome. Abel, pleasure was mine. Thank you for coming on today.
Thanks a lot, Sam. I appreciate you having me, man. And thanks for giving back and doing everything you do, because it takes a lot of time and effort to do what you're doing, but you're helping other people learn from others' experiences. And so anybody that's listening to this right now, absolutely need to go connect with Sam, go leave him the rating reviews, get all that good stuff. And he's providing you and serving you up some really good education and content and putting a lot of time and effort into it. So go support him.
Thanks, Abel, for the plug. I do appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.